From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherry Gross with Fresh Air. Don Ed Hardy is an artist who's running out of space, on his body, that is. Only his legs have been left untattooed. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with him about his work as a tattoo artist and historian. He learned his craft in the tattoo parlors of Southern California and in Japan, where he studied with Japanese masters. Also, we meet the editor of The New Republic, Andrew Sullivan. He was the first openly gay editor of a national political magazine. His new book, Virtually Normal, examines how our culture deals with homosexuality. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Gloria Steinem, and linguist Jeff Nunberg has some thoughts on the movement to declare English the official language of the U.S. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Frank Stacio. House Republicans today released a 60-page summary that outlines a plan to cut Medicare spending by $270 billion over the next 7 years. At a news conference today, House Speaker Newt Gingrich said the aim of the plan is to preserve the 30-year-old health program. President Clinton has threatened to veto what he calls the draconian cuts. And the White House today rejected a Republican budget proposal to keep the government from shutting down on October 1st. The president called the stopgap spending measure an attempt to blackmail the administration into accepting GOP spending priorities. The chairman of the Congressional Black Caucus says that while he would welcome the entrance of Colin Powell to the presidential race, African Americans aren't going to automatically support his candidacy. NPR's Philip Davis has more.
At the opening of the caucus's annual legislative conference in Washington, D.C., Representative Donald Payne of New Jersey said that a Colin Powell candidacy might get more people to become involved in the political process. But Payne says that so far, most of the activity in support of the former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff has been among moderately conservative white voters. Powell says that the black community needs to know more before it will back Powell.
We base our votes based on a person's platform that's going to empower and benefit African-American people or the people in our district. If his plans do not do that, he will not go overwhelmingly in our community.
Payne said that deciding to run is a personal decision that only Powell can make. This is Philip Davis in Washington.
In an important victory for tobacco companies, the Supreme Court in Canada has struck down a 1987 law that bans tobacco advertising. Lee Carter reports from Toronto.
Canada has had more stringent advertising restrictions than the United States. Billboard and magazine advertising, for instance, is completely banned. Today, the Supreme Court has agreed with the tobacco companies that such restrictions violate their freedom of expression and that they should be able to advertise the way they want to. The ruling will immediately scrap planned Canadian government legislation such as plain packaging for cigarettes, and it's not clear how much power the government will have to prevent the reverse of tobacco advertising bans. The ruling is a major victory for the tobacco companies who have spent millions of dollars fighting in the courts. It is a huge blow for non-smokers' rights groups and for health advocates, who had told the Supreme Court that 30,000 Canadians die each year from smoking-related illnesses. For National Public Radio, this is Lee Carter in Toronto.
A new study in Chicago shows that this summer's heat wave was far more deadly than previously thought. A report by the Chicago Health Department put the city's death count at 733, 210 more than the official figure. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down more than 26 points at 4767.04. This is NPR News. Defense Secretary William Perry says NATO airstrikes over Bosnia are still possible if the Bosnian Serbs do not continue to comply with NATO demands. Stefan Boz has more from Budapest.
Defense Secretary William Perry said NATO Supreme Commander General Joen is satisfied with the compliance of Bosnian Serbs with NATO demands. Mr. Perry said Bosnian Serb troops have withdrawn many heavy weapons from around Sarajevo and they have opened the airport and roads. But he warned the Bosnian Serbs that NATO actions are still an option.
The suspension of the airstrikes depends on the continued compliance.
Mr. Perry urged Russia not to criticize the NATO actions. Mr. Perry also said Central European countries like Hungary might join NATO soon. For National Public Radio, this is Stefan Boss in Budapest.
Still no progress reported in talks between Israel and the PLO concerning the expansion of self-rule in the West Bank, but negotiations are continuing. The main sticking point is how to handle autonomy in the city of Hebron, where 450 Jewish settlers live amid 120,000 Palestinians. The negotiations were called for under the Israeli PLO pact signed at the White House in 1993. An Iranian passenger aircraft that was hijacked to Israel returned today with 176 passengers and crew. The hijacker is identified as an Iranian flight attendant. He stayed behind in Israel and asked for asylum in the U.S. Iran portrayed the return of the plane as a victory against its archenemy Israel, which it accused of being behind the hijacking. Naval officials in South Africa today suspended the search for a whale caught in a piece of netting. Environmentalist Nan Rice said the greatest immediate danger is that the net might become hooked on rocks and trap the whale underwater. I'm Frank Stachow, National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tattoos inspire strong reactions. Tattoos can be magical or menacing, spiritual or macho. Some people get them for their beauty, some for the power to shock. My guest, Don Ed Hardy, is a tattoo artist and historian, as well as a painter. He's been an important figure in the broader recognition of tattoos as an art form. He opened his studio in San Francisco in 1974. In 1986, he moved to Honolulu and began publishing books on the history of tattooing and the work of tattoo artists. He's also organized several exhibitions of tattoo art. He co-curated a show of tattoo designs called Pierced Hearts and True Love, A Century of Drawings. It's on view through November 11th at the Drawing Center in Manhattan. His own art is on exhibit in Philadelphia at the Janet Fleischer Gallery. He describes the images on his own body as a conglomerate collection of Western traditional tattoos and large Japanese epic mythological torso tattoos.
I have an image of a ghost on my back from an 1840s print by Utagawa Kuniyoshi, one of the most famous of the ukiyo-e school Japanese printmakers. I have two Buddhist protectorate gods, a male and a female, divinities on my ribs that were also done in Japan. I've got a little cartoon 1940s duck on my arm. That's my current favorite tattoo that I got on my last birthday from my son, who's also a tattoo artist. I have a Buddhist rosary tattooed on my wrist that was done in Japan. A whole variety of images. There's a lot of things. Some are just kind of goofy souvenir things, little memorial pieces.
How does the cartoon duck get along with the more spiritual images?
I think it fits right in. It's kind of a great Zen tattoo. I've got a woman's face on my right arm, kind of in the bend of the arm, with My Life is a Dream in Spanish, Mi Vida es un Sueño. And it's this kind of like beautiful, surreal, you know, semi-serious design. And then I had this space on my left arm that I've been saving for years. And this duck is pointing at himself and saying, "Who me?" It's called the Who Me Duck, and it was a very popular kind of kitsch tattoo in during World War II, and I've always loved it just because it's so dopey. So I think it's a great kind of sobering counterpoint to the, you know, grandiosity of some of the other stuff.
It sounds like you've turned your body into something of a museum.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm wondering if you also feel that some of the images tattooed onto your body offer you any kind of Well, protection almost.
Yeah, I think that essentially all tattooing is sort of psychic armor, whether it's, you know, acknowledged by the people wearing them or not. But I think that's a lot of the intent behind it, to make people feel stronger and better about themselves. And, of course, it's just sort of a form of play, you know, dress up too. And, I love my tattoos. I've never regretted getting them. You know, I'm came into this thing very early in life and was just very attracted to it. So I think they're great. The only drawback to tattoos is that you do run out of space. It's not like collecting other
exactly.
things.
Exactly. So. Are you out yet?
Yeah, well, no, I'm not totally tattooed, and
what's
I probably
left?
Never will be. So
what's left?
Oh, I've got a lot of space on my legs, and kind of figure, like a friend of mine in the business says, well, it's like money in the bank, you know, having that open skin. So, you never know if you might want to find something that's, you know, seems like the right time to have something else put on.
Now, you've said that the process of applying a tattoo is so magical. The images have real power.
Mm-hmm.
What's magical and powerful about it?
Well, I think there's a lot of the fact that it is permanent, and the fact that a person is making a great commitment when they decide to become tattooed and are dealing with social forces, either positive or negative, depending on your society. In our society, it's been so marginalized and has so many negative connotations that it's took a sort of courage or single-mindedness, I think, for people to decide to be tattooed. I think there's just kind of a lot of psychological energy that gets involved with that, and you know, it's up to the artist to hopefully do their very best to transmit the kind of feeling that the person wants with the image, to make the process as easy as possible. And it's just a very key kind of a thing. I think that the doing of a tattoo, I was attracted to it. I got into tattooing ultimately from a fine arts background, and I was a printmaker, and I liked the finality of etching, of working on metal plates. But the finality of tattooing impressed me as a much more dramatic kind of art form. It was the most challenging medium that I could see.
What were the images that were popular when you started to get interested in tattooing? And you could tell us how old you were and what year that was. Mm-hmm. You know, put us in a context.
Yeah, I was. I reconnected with tattooing. I really got interested in tattooing in 1955 when I was 10. My mm-hmm. best friend's dad had tattoos. I thought it was the greatest kind of picture making I'd ever seen, and I began investigating these tattoo parlors that were about 20 miles north of where I grew up in Southern California. And I was too young for anyone to teach me, so I had a little toy tattoo shop I was doing with colored pencils on neighborhood kids, and that went on for about 3 years, and then I gave it up because I was too young to really get an apprenticeship in a tattoo shop. So I reconnected in 1966 when I was 21. I was finishing my undergraduate work at the San Francisco Art Institute, and the images then, the only things available were very traditional Americana things, hearts, daggers, eagles, sailing ships, religious images, cartoons. It was an image bank that had become codified by about the 1920s and remained virtually unchanged. I was interested in that as a kind of an American folk art form that no one had really looked at closely. And as I approached it from that side and thinking, well, this is kind of interesting kitsch, and remembered everything I'd learned about it when I was a little kid, a tattoo artist actually showed me a book of photos of Japanese tattooing, which featured much more designs that fit the body, larger scale designs, and the imagery was so much more sophisticated and based on classical Japanese myths and ukiyo-e pictorial forms. And I thought I was so blown away by the possibilities of it as a medium, that's what led me to want to get into it. I thought, well, if they can do it there, we could certainly develop this as a medium here in the West.
You in fact, studied with a Japanese tattoo master in mm-hmm. Japan.
Yeah, I eventually was able to go. I began tattooing in 1966 and then really had my first professional shop at the beginning of 1968. And in 73, I was able to move to Japan and live there for about 6 months working with a traditional tattoo master. And it was an incredible experience because it's a very, very hermetic culture over there, very private.
What was his philosophy?
Basically, he saw himself as the heir to a great tradition, Japanese decorative tattooing. The current solid era of it goes back to about 1800. He thought that he was very much continuing the lineage, the artistic aesthetics of the 19th century printmakers and the great 19th century tattooers. He was still applying most of his tattoos with hand tools, basing his images on the woodcut prints of that era. And so he was very, very much aware of his place in history, of continuing as a repository of Japanese mythology and symbolism, a lot of things in the traditional arts that have really died out among most parts of that society.
You know, I think of tattooing in America as being associated with macho, you know, guys mm-hmm. at sea, guys mm-hmm. in prison, the mermaid on the muscle on your arm or the mermaid on your stomach, I mm-hmm. guess. So when mm-hmm. when you move your stomach, the mermaid moves, or, you know, a tattoo on a muscle on your arms, so when you flex your muscle, the tattoo moves. But it's a real macho culture. I bet that's not what it was in Japan.
No, it was in Japan.
It was
very, macho? Oh, yeah. I think it was very, and there again, it was very much done as for an amuletic purpose. I think traditionally mm-hmm. The firemen, who were very, very important figures, real neighborhood heroes in Edo and, you know, the old-time Tokyo, where all the buildings were paper and wood and fires would spring up, and they were very serious business. So you'd have these fire brigades that were heavily tattooed, and they would throw off their kimonos when they go to fight the fire and display these dragons and other kind of protective deities tattooed on them. And they were the great dandies of the town and, you know, very brave people. So it definitely has that connotation over there. In fact, there are very few women even today that are tattooed in Japan, which is not the case in the West. I think in the West now, certainly in urban centers, New York, London, Paris, and, you know, San Francisco and all that, women make up more than half of the clientele.
I've always thought of women's tattoos as having these very chauvinistic roots. I mean, the cliche is, either a lovely little rose by a sexual part of your body, or a butterfly, or on the other side, I guess this is from biker culture, the kind of Bob's Girl tattoo by your pubic hair or something, or on your behind. Do you find that women's tattoos are becoming less male defined like that?
Definitely. I think some of the most interesting and incredible, unusual creations that are being commissioned are on women and often by women tattoo artists. And you have to remember, too, that because tattooing has been so marginalized, that many of these cliches were only the most public, the most visible aspects, the tip of the tattoo iceberg of the kinds of people who were flamboyant enough to be strutting this kind of thing and, you know, basically loudmouth and whatever about their tattoos in public. So you get, you know, biker chicks and hog riding fools and then, drunken sailors and all that. And this has become the stereotype. But in fact, I think that all types of people have always gotten tattoos. It's just in the past they have felt more secretive about them, have felt ashamed of, have been made to feel ashamed of them so that they tend to hide them, you know, so that someone coming back from, say, their career in the Navy, and maybe they got a few tattoos, they would go back to some small rural town and the local people, you know, church-going people and all that say, oh my God, this is awful, this is a barbaric mark. So instead of standing up for it and saying, yes, I got this, this was a sign of real bonding of an experience that I went through, I did my military thing, we were under a great deal of duress, we were in the war or whatever, and being proud of it, they would say, oh, well, yeah, I was drunk and I shouldn't have gotten it. And they would succumb to those kind of mores that were, you know, endemic to their society at large. So a lot of the cliche things just simply weren't widespread, you know, true of the greater tattooed populace.
I'm curious, though, I know you've looked at the history of tattoos a lot. Why has tattooing become such a part of culture at sea or prison culture?
I think, well, particularly in people that are in controlled communities and people that are in uniform, whether in penal institutions or in a military setting, it's a way of extreme individuation, of a way to assert yourself and say, well, they can put me in this uniform, they can give me the military haircut, they can make me talk the talk, but I can get the tattoo. And especially with seafaring people as well, when they were living, whether it was with merchant seamen in the old days on the wooden ships or, you know, modern-day sailors, living in extremely tight quarters where your possessions were very, very reduced, you know, you wouldn't have room for a collection of anything that would take up any space, but your tattoos aren't going to take up space, and they'll be with you. You know, it's a sort of mobile, it's like an epidermal diary, you know, of what has gone on in your life. And the tattoos themselves, again, in light of looking at tattooing, say, as a medium, as an art form, you can't consider it strictly in formal terms that you would apply to an inanimate thing that you would apply to a sculpture or a painting, because the tattoo is really just the entry point for the life story of the person that's wearing it. And this is what gives it its real, completes the circuit for a person to say, oh, you know, what an interesting tattoo, or what's that about? When did you get that? Maybe it's not even that great looking a tattoo, but it might have a great deal of meaning to the person wearing it because of the circumstances under which it was done, the person that applied it to them, the thing that it stood for, you know.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Donnette Hardy. He's a well-known tattoo artist and co-curated a show that's now in New York and Soho called Pierced Hearts and True Love, A Century of Drawings for Tattoos. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Donnette Hardy. He's a tattoo artist who also co-curated a show of drawings for tattoos called Pierced Hearts and True Love, and the show is now on exhibit in Soho in Manhattan. I want to talk more about what it was like for you when you were getting started. You grew up in Southern California, and when you realized how interested you were in tattoos, you hung out at tattoo parlors. What was it like around those tattoo parlors then?
It was very much a typical kind of honky-tonk environment. These shops that I was able to visit were on the Pike in Long Beach. It was an amusement park established in the late 19th century. It was very much the Coney Island of the West Coast. And there were a lot of sailors. Long Beach was a great naval port in those days. And there were, you know, people on holiday, weekends especially. I would ride the Greyhound up there. It was like a 30-minute ride. And people would come in and pick out tattoos off the flash on the wall. The shops were all quite busy, very brightly lit, very, you know, it was just kind of a honky-tonk amusement park atmosphere. It was very exciting. I thought it was incredible to be in these shops because the images on the wall were, you know, they were bright, they were dramatic, they reflected all these sort of encoded great, you know, emotions that certainly had a tremendous draw to a 10-year-old boy. It was like, wow, look at this stuff, you know, these really wild design. So I just thought it was fascinating, and it definitely shaped my approach to art, you know, as I kind of went into the fine arts later in life.
There's a great set of pictures of you in one of your books, a book called Rock of Ages. And on the left-hand page, there's a picture of you standing in front of your Lutheran church, and you're wearing a robe and I think a little bow tie or
right,
something,
yeah.
Looking like quite the choir boy.
Mm-hmm.
Then on the opposite page is a picture of you, same age, I don't know, you look about 10 or something,
mm-hmm.
and you have this big tattoo on your chest. It's something I think that was penciled on, that you penciled on, and
mm-hmm.
it's a Rock of Ages tattoo. But what a contrast between those two yous. You must have had a foot in two very different worlds.
Yeah,
growing
well,
up.
I was made to go to church. I mean, my mother really meant well, you know, and she did definitely give me a lot of great grounding in morals and values and all that. I didn't really buy the church party line, but you know, I had to do all that thing, and I just was so obsessed with tattooing. I would sit, you know, in church and draw these tattoo designs on the little programs, and I would request the hymn Rock of Ages because it made me think about being in Long Beach in the tattoo shop. And
yeah, what's the Rock of Ages image in tattoos?
It's this kitsch image that was really like a Courier and Ives-style litho that was a religious lithograph that was very popular from, I think they started right around the mid-19th century up probably through the turn of the 20th century, and I think probably millions of them were produced. Found in all sorts of homes, and it was this image of a woman clinging to a big rugged granite cross in the middle of a stormy sea, usually with a sinking, you know, sailing ship in the background. And I could not find out who originated this series of images. There's actually a series of the woman coming out of the water and then being up hanging on the cross, and another one with two women in it. But I think possibly they were originated by a German artist in the 19th century, but it became a very standard tattoo back piece. The tattoo artist realized that this poster was exactly the right size to do as a back design, and someone got the idea to paint it up as such. So this was in the tattoo shop still when I was a kid. It was really, had sort of lost its popularity maybe from the 30s on, but I was just fascinated by it. I would draw versions of it, and again, because I was press ganged into sort of a, you know, this Lutheran upbringing, and so I was around a lot of crosses and stuff. So that was it.
So when you started to learn how to do tattoos, were you using the same process that you use now, or has there been an advancement in the technology?
There's a greater range of pigments, and there are some fine-tuning adjustments to the machines and that, but essentially the process has stayed the same for, you know, this whole century.
Would you describe a little what the process is for those of us who don't have tattoos?
Yeah, it's a machine that's built pretty much like on the principle of a doorbell with two wire wrap coils and a circuit breaker, a little armature bar at the top. There's a series of very fine needles soldered onto a long bar that runs down through a pen-like kind of a tube that attaches to the power unit. And these vibrate up and down about 3,000 RPM. It runs off direct current, and you dip into the pigment and then draw that on the skin. And it's kind of akin to drawing with colored pencils or something. It requires, of course, a great sureness of hand. And then all the pigments, everything's thrown away at the end of the tattoo. Everything's single service now, of course. Everything's sterilized. We wear gloves. It's all the, you know, precautions are taken that any doctor's office would take.
And how deep do the needles have to go?
It's about a 32nd of an inch. It's into just the top of the dermal layer. So
mm-hmm.
a lot of it, I mean, the machines don't really do the work on their own. It's very much up to the touch of the tattoo artist. It's a very sensitive thing. I think skin is an incredibly complex medium to work in because of the variables of it, person to person and one area of the body to another.
So how much of an issue is pain for the average person getting a tattoo?
I think everyone is concerned a great deal about it, although they don't really hurt that badly. It's very hard to equate it to something else. It's a surface burning sensation. I mean, it's not something you'd sleep through, but it's certainly not unbearable. Of course, some areas of the body, you know, the center of your chest or on your spine or rib or a more protected area like that, it's more intense, but it's not that big an issue, really.
Mm-hmm. So the pain doesn't bother you when you get it done?
Well, it's not something I enjoy, but frankly, every time I get a tattoo, I think, oh, geez, I guess I have enough already? I sort of forgot these things hurt, you know, but it's not, it doesn't go on for that long. You know, the tattoo might take 20 minutes, might take an hour, maybe an extreme thing you'd work for 2 or 3 hours, and it's bearable, and then, you know, then you have it, so you've got it there forever, so I think it's worth going through.
Were you ever in a jam where somebody was about to threaten you, and then they saw your tattoos and thought, well, here's a strange, eccentric guy, I think I'll leave him alone?
Actually, since I believe in the kind of, you know, the shock value of the tattoos, I used to go visit another friend that tattooed on the Lower East Side here in New York, and I was he was on 4th between C and D, which is a pretty bad neighborhood. It certainly was in those days. I don't know how it is these days, but sometimes a cab wouldn't even take us in there. They'd make us get out a couple of blocks before because it was all drug dealers and burnout buildings and very threatening. So just as a matter of course, I made sure I would roll up my sleeves and show that I wasn't just another, you know, dopey white guy walking in there with a big expensive camera, because I was always carrying my camera in to photograph his work and his drawings and all that. And actually, people would see the tattoos and they'd go, oh, you're going to see DeVita, you know, you're going to go down to the Tattoo Man, because he was known in the neighborhood. He was the Tattoo Man, and he sort of had this, you know, he was like the shaman's place. He was raised in the Lower East Side. He fit into the environment. But it is an icebreaker in a lot of cultures where they don't identify you perhaps from your perception as a certain race or a certain socioeconomic thing. It identifies you as a member of perhaps a larger, wacky international tribe, you know. So I like that.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Okay.
Don Ed Hardy co-curated an exhibit of tattoo art called Pierced Hearts and True Love, which is currently on view at the Drawing Center in Manhattan. It'll tour over the next year to Miami, San Francisco, and Williamstown, Massachusetts. Our thanks to Michael McCabe, a consultant to the exhibit. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Me and my brother were talking to each other about what makes a man a man. Was it brain or brawn or the month you were born? We just couldn't understand. Our old man didn't like our appearance. He said that only women wear a long hair. So me and my brother borrowed money from mother. We knew what we had to do. We went downstairs past the barber and gymnasium and got our arms tattooed. Welcome to my life, tattoo. I'm a man now, thanks to you. I expect I'll regret you, but the skin rough man won't get you. You'll be there when I die. Tattoo.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, a conversation with Andrew Sullivan, editor of The New Republic. He's the first openly gay editor of a national political magazine. His new book examines how our society deals with homosexuality. Book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews a new biography of Gloria Steinem, and linguist Jeff Nunberg considers the movement to make English the official language of the U.S. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. There's plenty to read by and about Gloria Steinem. You can add to that a new biography. For her biography of Gloria Steinem, Carolyn Heilbrunn interviewed Steinem's friends, relatives, political allies, and Steinem herself. But despite all the research, Heilbrunn says Steinem's personality remains elusive. Book critic Maureen Corrigan agrees.
Sometimes you can tell a book by its cover, and unfortunately this is the case with Carolyn Heilbrunn's biography of Gloria Steinem, The Education of a Woman. Rather than a photograph, the book jacket features an agitprop-type illustration of Steinem's head. Think Lenin or Che Guevara. Steinem smiles with uplifted chin, her eyes fixed on that utopian future when the swimsuit competition will be voted out, the ERA voted in, and the Citadel will make the second sex required reading. As art, the Steinem head is inspirational yet flat, like a holy card. And that's pretty much the way Heilbrunn's biography reads. It's adulatory towards Steinem and discreet. Instead of illuminating the dark patches of Steinem's psyche and public life, Heilbrunn mostly lights candles before her shrine. This is a real shame because the wedding of Heilbrunn as biographer and Steinem as subject would seem to be a match made in heaven. As prominent feminists, they both popularized feminist theory for a wide and sometimes wary audience. Heilbrunn is probably best known for her 1988 book, Writing a Woman's Life, in which she discussed the art of biography and criticized the traditional biographers of Charlotte Bronte and George Sand for failing to do justice to their subjects' unwomanly ambitions. In Steinem, Heilbrunn found precisely the kind of paradoxical, unconventional woman whose life, if told fully, could enlarge the available female scripts that still shape and often limit other women's destinies. Born into working-class East Toledo, Steinem spent most of her adolescence living in crummy, roach-infested apartments, caring for her mentally ill mother. In the early 1950s, Steinem managed to get into Smith and then launched herself as a freelance journalist in New York, where she was dubbed the world's most beautiful byline. By the late 60s, she had transformed again from a journalist to a media symbol of feminism. Throughout her life, Steinem has dated rich and powerful men. Heilbrunn even reveals a secret tryst with feminist foe Norman Mailer. But she's always refused marriage. Why Steinem evaded the marriage plot, which was the almost universal fate of women of her generation, is a mystery Heilbrunn ponders and then drops. We learn even less about the motives that drove Steinem to seek fame as a journalist and activist, or about the anger she would have to have harbored against her mother. Instead, we get commentary like, Steinem has never lost her profound belief in inherent human goodness. Well, I'm relieved, but doesn't she ever belch? Anyone who survived trashings by Betty Friedan and indirectly the Pope is tough enough to withstand a more probing, less protective biographer. Heilbrunn does some things well, like explicate the media's distorted coverage of the women's movement, but ultimately she's led too much by her admiration for her subject. It's almost as if Heilbrunn confused Steinem with Kate Fansler, the serene, swan-like protagonist of her effete academic mystery series written under the pen name Amanda Cross. But writing the story of a working-class girl from East Toledo who grew up to be Gloria Steinem requires a hard-boiled sensibility that Professor Heilbrunn can't quite muster.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed Carolyn Heilbrunn's biography of Gloria Steinem. When Andrew Sullivan became the editor of The New Republic in 1991, it made news. He was an Englishman at a magazine covering American politics and culture. He was very young, age 28, and he was the first openly gay editor of a national political magazine. Now Sullivan has written a new book about our society's attitudes towards homosexuality. It's called Virtually Normal. He describes his book as an attempt to think through the arguments on all sides as carefully and honestly as possible, to take the unalterable experience of all of us, heterosexual and homosexual, and try to make some social and political sense of it. After outlining the different political views in the debate over homosexuality, Sullivan says they often miss an essential point.
When I ask myself, what is homosexuality, I come up with the answer, it's really the emotional bonding, the emotional and sexual bonding of two people of the same gender, just as heterosexuality is the emotional and sexual bonding of people of the opposite gender.
So for you, the core of the issue has in part to do with recognizing the legitimacy of gay marriage.
Yeah, I mean, the legal and political institution which is most appropriate and relevant to emotional bonding is simply marriage. Not gay marriage, marriage, as we have come to understand it. And I know that's hard, and it's been very hard to explain why that's so central and important. A lot of people think, well, I can go with you a lot of the way here, but look, that's pushing it a little too far.
I wonder if after writing Virtually Normal you felt any closer to understanding why a certain segment of the population is truly just reviled, repulsed by the very idea of homosexuality.
Well, I think it's partly because they define or understand homosexuality as a sexual act and are repelled by that sexual act. Somewhere deep down, I think that is what is operating. But of course, part of what I'm trying to say in the book is that homosexuals spend maybe 1/1000th of our time engaged in a sexual act, just as heterosexuals are engaged, 1/1000th of their time in such an act. But the rest of the time, our emotional lives, the people we love, the people we care for, are part of that profound emotional orientation. The trouble, of course, is we don't even have a language to talk about that orientation because we don't have the institutions which reflect it. In other words, we can't talk about our husbands and wives and children. I had an interesting conversation recently with a woman that I met who was on this tour, and we were talking for a while, and she said that she, during that time, we'd been traveling around, and she'd noticed some attractive men, and she had remarked upon that, but she'd also talked about herself. And she also remembered having gay friends where she used to live and how they used to hold parties, and she enjoyed that. And I asked her, did they ever say they were gay? And she said, no, they didn't. But why should they? Why should you bring it up all the time? And I said to her, but you've brought up your heterosexuality hundreds of times just in the last 2 hours. And she said, what you mean when I talked about being attracted to those men over there? And I said, no, you've talked about your husband, your family, your children. You have all these things which you talk about, and all of them reflect effortlessly as part of the fabric of your life, your heterosexuality. But I can't do that. And part of it is because we don't have the institutions which allow us to do that. I don't want to talk about sex in public. I don't think it's appropriate. I do want to talk about families in public. I do want to talk about my friends. I do want to talk about my relationships. And that's a whole different order. And it's equalizing the way we even talk about the subject between straight people and gay people that I'm really trying to do.
Andrew Sullivan is my guest. He's the editor of The New Republic. And you were actually the first gay out-of-the-closet editor of a national political magazine. You were appointed in 1991, I believe it was, at the age of 28. And you've said that you were concerned at first that you'd be perceived at the magazine as a cheerleader for a particular gay agenda. What were your concerns?
Well, I'll tell you a story. I was, my first interview was with Time magazine when I got the job, and they asked me in a half-hour interview all sorts of questions about what I wanted to do with the magazine and what my opinions were on this, that, and the other. And then at the end of it, the guy shifted nervously in his chair and said, "And you're gay, right?" And I said, "Yeah, I always have been. I never made a secret of it, at least not in the last few years." And that was the end of the conversation. And in the lead of the first paragraph of the article, I was described as outspokenly gay. And I did not want, and I think very few gay professionals want to be known as the gay editor, the gay writer, the gay politician, the gay businessman. We're editors, we're writers, we're businessmen, we're entrepreneurs, who we're doctors, we're in every profession, and we happen to be gay. And to avoid being pushed into that position, I think, is something that one wanted. And a lot of people avoid that by not coming out of the closet. I felt that's ducking the issue. You come out of the closet and then you try and prove by what you say and do that you're more than that label.
So what are the...
Also, yeah. Let me answer that question more fully. As an editor of a political magazine and of the way I've edited the magazine, I want to make sure that a variety of different views are there and that a variety of different perspectives are there, and that I'm not, I'm open to argument, and that as an editor I can distance myself from my own identity.
Have there been pressures on you to write any more or any less about gay issues in the New Republic?
Well, there's been mainly a lot of pressure that, and an argument that I've been doing too much.
Mm-hmm.
And
who makes the argument?
Oh, well, there was various conservatives. There was an article in the Washingtonian which implied, I don't think maybe in these words, that I was turning this into a quote-unquote gay rag. And, you know, I went back in 1994, just out of interest, and counted up the number of gay stories. Another editor, actually, had said to me also, "Didn't you do did how many cover stories on gay issues last year? Five? We'd done one." I added up the stories that we'd actually done on gay issues. Out of over 800 separate articles we publish a year, only 14 had been about gay or lesbian subjects. But because we are so unused to talking about this as if it were a legitimate subject for public discourse, they stand out. It's all people see. But I've insisted on trying to normalize this subject, to get it like any other subject, to get it on the table as something we don't have to treat as a taboo, as we have to treat as an issue. Just as, in my own family, for example, at some point the issue of my being gay had to be just put on the table and dealt with, and then we can move beyond it and talk about it reasonably.
Andrew Sullivan is my guest. He's the author of the new book, Virtually Normal, An Argument About Homosexuality, and he's the editor of The New Republic. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Andrew Sullivan is my guest, the author of the new book, Virtually Normal, An Argument About Homosexuality, and the editor of The New Republic. You've been the editor of The New Republic for one presidential campaign.
Yes.
Right. And so during the campaign of, Clinton versus Bush, The New Republic really supported Clinton.
Yes.
And since his election, The New Republic has expressed time and time again a lot of disappointment and Clinton's performance. So what has the experience been like for you, heading up a magazine, writing these editorials, and having such a change of heart, seeing your candidate actually in action?
Well, I think our magazine reflects a lot of people's feelings out there about Clinton. I think there was a real hope that he could represent a new democratic approach, someone who would be free from both the sort of ideological cant of the right and yet also not beholden to the special interest groups of the left, and could steer a clear and determined path between the two. And, of course, I think we all felt from the beginning, you know, when the gays and the military issue was perhaps paradigmatic of that, that, gosh, maybe he was saying all these things just to get elected. Maybe they weren't reflecting a deep conviction about where he stood. I mean, for example, on that issue, it's astonishing to me. He never once, I didn't see, in those 6 months of debate, ever really say, make an argument for why he was doing it. I mean, how on earth do you think you're going to affect and change something so profound without even making your case? I do not know. But you see, I think Bill Clinton believed in doing good to homosexuals. I don't think he really believed in the equality of homosexuals, which is why when it came down to it, he couldn't actually argue for simple citizens' equality in such a public institution as the military. And that lack of conviction could be extended to so many other issues. Bosnia, for example, or, you know, the economy, the deficit, which he campaigned on reducing, that he then fudged and handed to the opposition. Welfare reform, which he campaigned on, and which, you know, now is only now, really, with a Gingrich Congress, is actually getting anywhere because he bungled it.
Would you like to see Colin Powell make a run for the presidency?
You know, actually, I would.
Now, I know you won't agree with him on his stand on gays in the military. He's against allowing people who are openly gay to
serve. A crushing blow. Mm-hmm. To the point that we were trying to make about our equal dignity and why the equal dignity of African Americans and women and these other should be understood in the same way. But I'm in favor of him because I really think that anything that can break out of this rather log-jammed, religious right-dominated Republican Party and kind of drifting Democratic Party that can break up the argument, that can really force people to address and fight for the center and make intelligent arguments, is for the better. If a Powell candidacy or a third candidacy or a fourth candidacy could do that, then great. You know, many of us, I don't think any more, if we've ever, I mean, in my case, never, I mean, think of ourselves as independents. Certainly the New Republic, in a way, I think of our readers as essentially independents or independently minded Democrats and Republicans. And you know, the institutional structure of American politics right now is not listening or answering that essential need. I think if Powell could do that, great.
You've written some very trenchant and very funny things about the nature of celebrity in America. And you've said, there is one currency in this world, and that is celebrity. What do you mean?
Well, I guess I was talking there about John F. Kennedy Jr. in a way, and how in the magazine world, for example, in the 80s, they tried to turn all these editors into celebrities, and now they're trying to turn celebrities into editors. and and what we've forgotten is, you know, what are we doing? We're putting out magazines. Now, I have to bear some of the blame for that. You know, the lure of celebrity in this culture, you know, the glamour of being someone who's recognized or so on and so forth. I mean, I did a Gap ad, and you can't get more sort of craven obedience to celebrity than that. But I feel that in some ways it can go too far, and that we're beginning to crave celebrity without substance.
I'm going to put you on the spot. Two of your former colleagues from the New Republic are at the New Yorker now, Hendrik Hertzberg and Sidney Blumenthal.
Yeah.
What do you think of the New Yorker now?
Boy. I think there are some great things in the New Yorker and some wonderful journalism in the New Yorker. I certainly think that the old New Yorker was really moribund in its old incarnation. On the other hand, I do think part of the problem with trying to turn what is essentially a serious magazine into a mass magazine, an appeal to Hollywood, an appeal to that kind of culture, is that you're buying into the cult of celebrity rather than substance. You're often condescending, I think, to your readers, and sometimes not granting them the intelligence that they really have, and dumbing some stuff down, which I think is a shame. Not all of it is that. But, you know, I actually heard that Roseanne was now a contributing editor. And, you know, this is the New Yorker. And at some level, that had an institutional importance in our culture, which I think was important and I think maybe has been lost. I mean, when I took over the New Republic, there were lots of things I wanted to do with the New Republic. But I also thought it was a wonderful magazine before I took it over and was very aware of its standards and have tried to incorporate new influences and subjects and writers into that tradition. And what I think's happened in The New Yorker is that essentially it's really another Condé Nast magazine now, and maybe lost what was so... I mean, it's lost its mystery. And you like to think that a magazine was publishing simply because this is what this group of people wanted to publish, not because they were desperate to impress the movers and shakers in Hollywood and Washington and New York. And after a while, the mystery goes, and the mystery is part of a lot of the institutions that make sense of our lives.
Well, Andrew Sullivan, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Tara. It's been a great pleasure.
Andrew Sullivan is the editor of The New Republic and the author of the new book, Virtually Normal, An Argument About Homosexuality. This is Fresh Air. Many Americans despair that recent immigrants don't seem as willing to learn English as earlier generations were. This has led to a political movement to declare English the official language of the U.S. All this troubles our linguist, Jeff Nunberg.
Up to a few weeks ago, my favorite example of linguistic imbecility in high places was the probably apocryphal story of the Texas school superintendent who refused to allow his pupils to be instructed in a foreign language on the grounds that if English was good enough for Jesus, it was good enough for them. Now, however, I can replace that mythical school official with another Texan, this one a flesh-and-blood judge from Amarillo named Samuel Kaiser. Kaiser, you may have seen, was the judge at a recent custody hearing who ordered a bilingual Mexican-American mother to speak English to her 5-year-old daughter or have the daughter removed by the court. Kaiser said that by speaking to the child chiefly in Spanish, the mother was engaging in a form of child abuse, since it meant that the child would be behind her classmates when she started first grade. As the judge put it, what are you trying to do, make her a maid for the rest of her life? Kaiser later issued a statement retracting the use of the word abuse to describe the mother's conduct and apologizing to the housekeeping profession, which he said he held in the highest esteem. But he also said he was going to let the order stand. I'll leave it to constitutional experts to comment on the presumption of a judge telling a mother what language she should use when she talks to her child, though you sort of have the feeling that if that doesn't count as protected speech, we could all be in big trouble. But if we can't screen judges for arrogance, we could at least require them to know a little history. How does Judge Kaiser think the children of previous generations of immigrants learned English? Does he imagine their parents all went to night school before they had babies so they could teach their children English from the cradle? I estimate there are at least 20 million adult Americans who could disabuse him of that notion, people who were raised in homes where nobody spoke anything but Italian or Yiddish or Chinese, and who got their first taste of English on the street or in the classroom. Yet I've never met anybody who resented his parents for insisting that their children learn the language of the old country, the way that Texas mother has. If second-generation immigrants complain of being abused, they're more likely to point at teachers and school systems who gave them a hard time before they could make the transition to English. In the end, though, they did all catch up. At that age, kids have a biologically based capacity to learn language, which disappears in later life. And needless to say, most of those 25 million or so late starters haven't wound up spending the rest of their lives as maids and gardeners, despite Judge Kaiser's concerns. You have to wonder if he would have made the remark if the mother in question had been French or German rather than Hispanic. That's the way it's always worked in America. The first-generation immigrants are usually too old or too busy to learn English well. Their children are bilingual, but with a clear preference for English as they move out into the wider world. And the next generation, in turn, are usually monolingual English speakers, though they're generally sorry about it. That's the ironic part of the story when you see these third-generation kids in first-year college courses in Italian or Japanese struggling to pick up a few scraps of the language that their parents turned their backs on. The newest immigrants are no exceptions to the pattern. There was a RAND Corporation study a few years ago that showed that 95% of Hispanics born in California speak English fluently, and that fewer than half of the next generation can still speak Spanish. Yet despite all the evidence, people keep wanting to claim that the recent immigrants are different from our own immigrant ancestors. This lot doesn't want to learn English, doesn't want to become part of the American community, and so on. Of course, there's nothing new in this kind of charge either. In 1920, the U.S. Attorney General was complaining that the recent immigrants from Italy and Eastern Europe were nothing like the earlier immigrants who had built up America. The difference, he said, was like the difference between rats and beavers. It's a chronic lapse of memory in American political life, which seems to afflict us as soon as our grandparents' voices fade.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Xerox Palo Alto Research Center. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Technical direction from Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Living Language. Language instruction at home or on the go with Living Language. Celebrating 25 years of radio excellence, this is NPR, National Public Radio.